Hi, I'm Kelly, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 14th of 2004. I have a sponsor. I get to the privilege of sponsoring other women today, and I have a home group. It's called the Broad Highway. We meet Saturday mornings at 9:30. It's in Bethesda, Maryland. So if you're, it's a women's meeting. So if you're a woman and you're in the area and you know you're going to be in the area, please let me know. I love that group. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am sober today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of a sponsor, working with other women, a higher power, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and being of service. Everything else in my life is an absolute gift, and those things that I just said have transformed into a gift into my life. Because when I got sober at 23, and I thought my life was over. I did not want to be sober. It talks about in the Big Book, I could not imagine my life going on anymore like the way it was going, but I couldn't imagine it any other way. I felt absolutely dead inside, and it was, I don't know, what happened was is that there's this thing, the Big Book, and a woman that came into my life and who was sober, and she took me through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the steps is where my life transformed and becoming and not doing my will, but believing in a higher power, you know. And I'm actually a happy person today, which is so crazy. People would, strangers would come up to me at random places and tell me to smile, and it wasn't so bad, you know, because I would walk around with this misery, and like everyone around me would get this like just effect. It was like the tornado roaring through people's lives over and over again. Family members, strangers, friends, anybody. Anytime I entered someone's life, it was kind of like just kind of a ruin, you know. I was a taker. I wanted to feel better. I didn't like the fact that I would physically abuse my father and I would say horrible things to him. I'm not proud of that kind of stuff. And I didn't like it why I was doing it. But he stood in the way from me and drinking. I didn't like the fact that he would cry all the time. Not all the time, but he would tear up at certain times. I didn't like the fact that my mother did cry all the time, that she was terrified to pick up the phone, scared it was going to be someone telling her that something horrible had happened to me, because it did. My family got a lot of phone calls about me. They had to pick me up from a lot of places. They had to drag me out of a lot of places, and so they saw a lot of it, you know, and it's not like that today. I am going to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. But I do have to say is that I have amazing relationships with my family today. I have amazing relationships with people, with friends. I have friends today, you know. I have a loving husband who's also sober today that I am in a true partnership. And it talks about in the Big Book our true inability to form a, I don't memorize stuff, but our true inability to form a partnership with another human being, you know. I know I have that stuff today. My parents worry about me as anyone would worry about their child, you know, but they don't worry about the cops showing up at their house. They don't worry about the hospitals. They don't worry like that today. And that's not me just getting myself together, you know. That was intervention of a higher power in my life today, and that was the steps. So how I got here, I grew up in Potomac, Maryland, which is about an hour and a half from here. My parents have been married for 41 years. Oh, sorry, I knocked that over. So they're pretty normal. They don't really drink that much. I have an older brother who's a year and a half older than me. He partied just like I did. On the outside, it kind of looked like this similar, but there's a lot more different going on. But looking at our family, everything kind of looked picture perfect. You know, we had the house in Potomac. It was like the white picket fence without the white picket fence kind of idea with the golden retriever, the ideal family it almost felt like. But and I don't know what happened to me. I don't know why I looked at other people and I compared my insides without your outsides. I don't know why I wanted to be you. I didn't know anything about you, but I hated myself. And I don't know where I got that. My parents tried to give me everything, and it was never good enough. And I do remember being at a young age on some road trip and looking at the car next to me and thinking, I want to be that person in that car. And I don't know where that came from, you know. But what I do know what happened to me and what differs me from, like, my family members or a non-alcoholic is what alcohol did for me. I know a lot of people like to drink, but my whole perception on life and what was going on was just so off. And when I took that drink, a couple of things happened. One, I felt like I could breathe. I felt like I could be in my own skin. I felt like just this huge weight lifted off my shoulders, and I stopped caring that I hurt people. I felt like I could live with myself a little bit more, and I felt at peace. And two, whenever I started drinking, all bets were off. I didn't know if I was going to end up in an alleyway in D.C., which I did. I didn't know if I was going to end up in another state, which I've done. I didn't know if I was going to end up in my own bedroom, which has happened too, or in another place in the house, or outside, or in jail. I didn't know what was going to happen, or in a hospital. 'Cause when I started drinking, what happened was I lost all inability to stop, unless it was physically taken away from me, and which talks about in the big book, it's the phenomenon of craving, which I did not have these words when I was 14 years old. All I knew is that I felt uncomfortable, and I was at Ocean City, Maryland, and I was with this girl who, to me, she looked perfect. I wanted to be this person, and the guys kind of flocked to her. But when I drank that warm beer, I didn't care. I didn't care that I was coughing up a cigarette. I did not care that, you know, what was going on around me. And I wanted to do that going forward. And so I started stealing my parents' liquor. I mean, the liquor cabinet was open. Why not, right? Why wouldn't you make it, pour yourself a glass of vodka during a Tuesday afternoon? I mean, why wouldn't you, you know? That was, like, common sense to me. And, you know, and I had some friends. And, like, we had, like, a normal life, you know. Nothing crazy was happening. But it was very quick to make the decision of what I was going to do and what I wasn't going to do. The friend would be like, if you're going to drink, I'm going to leave. Well, then, okay, well, there's the door, you know. And it was a Tuesday afternoon. I was 15, and I went downstairs, and I poured a glass of vodka, and I went back upstairs to my room. Nothing, I mean, it had happened plenty of times before, and my mom had come home, and I kind of panicked, and so I left, and I was kind of walking around the neighborhood, and I ended up at this girl's house, and they had this intervention. I started blacking out very quickly. I was very messy, angry, sometimes very sad, drunk. It kind of varied. Never knew what that right concoction was because I always missed the mark. You know, I could black out off a couple of beers, or I could drink a 30-pack and still be walking, or a bottle of vodka and be fine, you know. I mean, obviously very drunk, but think you could drive and do all this stuff. And, you know, so they had this intervention, and I had, you know, I was young, you know, and I had this first look in the mirror, and I remember I looked at myself, and I hated everything about myself, and I thought, my rationalization about everything was just very off, and I thought if I disappeared or made myself invincible, I'd be better, or I'd feel better, or something would happen, and so I colored myself in with magic markers. It was like a warm summer day. My parents took me to the hospital. The hospital then was like, she needs to go to a psych ward, you know, there's something wrong with this girl, and so I went to a psych ward, and that was one of my, I don't know. I've tried to keep count of how many, but I mean, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter as much because it talks about it doesn't matter the quantities of one that how much you drink, you know, or how old you are, you know. I certainly, when I was 16 and being sent to my first AA meeting, I thought this is a joke, you know. I'm not like you people, but I think I spent from. After I got out of that psych ward, from 15 to 23, going to a rehab, going to rehabs, doctors, psychiatrists, therapists, hospital visits. I did a neurologist visit at one point. My parents were convinced there was something wrong with my brain. I was 20 years old at the time. And so they brought me home. I was living at home, or I was at a break or something, and so they took me to see a neurologist. And, you know, this whole day, it was like, I was pissed, first of all, because I had to go see a neurologist. And I thought that was so unfair. You know, I was always kind of like, why are you doing this to me? Just let me be. And it was always their fault. It was, you did this, you did that. You know, never really looking at, like, my responsibility or my life. And so I went to this neurologist, and you know, it's downtown D.C. It was on a Monday or Tuesday morning or something, so everyone's dressed very nicely, going to work and all that stuff, and I'm there in my pajamas with my dad, and I'm really pissed off at him, and I couldn't believe he was doing this to me, not thinking once, like, what I'm putting him through. Like, he's taking the day off of work. He's taking his daughter to a neurologist because they think something's wrong with her because she can't stop drinking, and or they didn't really know what to do, you know. And so we went in, and they did all these tests. And one of the tests was that they were going to test my brain waves. So I had to put little wires attached to my head, and they had to attach a monitor to me. And they wrapped this, like, cloth around my head that looked like a diaper, you know. And it's just – and so I'm leaving downtown D.C. It's now noon. Everyone's out on their lunch break, you know. And I'm walking with my dad with this monitor and all these wires, and I'm pissed off at him, you know. And, like, how could you do this to me? And a couple of days later, they got the results, and you know, and it's just more excuses I would make for my drinking. And they got this result. They said that one part of my brain didn't work as fast as my other, so therefore my decision making was off. And for me, that was like, I rode with that one for a while, you know, like, this is why I do what I do, you know. And you know, I was on lots of medications. I was, you know, seeing doctors and everything. And I always remember, and I don't know when this, like, made sense to me, but I'd always sit there and, you know, tell a doctor or a psychiatrist, therapist, like, you know, I just need to put the puzzle pieces back together on the inside because I'm not right. And she always said, you're working with the wrong pieces. You know, they don't match up. And I just, like, and then that makes sense. And now it makes sense today. It's like I was doing whatever I could to try to fix myself. And even in a sobriety, I was trying to fix myself with other things, whether it was men, food, money, clothes, the way I looked. I wanted something to fix me. And for a long time is what I, you know, believed, that alcohol was my solution. I was not a problem drinker. I drank just fine. But alcohol was my solution for living. You know, it solved all my problems, or what I thought was my problem. And what I thought was, this world was so chaotic that let me drink and I'll feel better. But the problem is, like, when I drank, I created so much chaos for people, you know. And I had, around this, back earlier in high school, I met this guy that we were together for about 6 years, you know, and he saw so much of my drinking. And anytime an argument, it was because of my drinking. And, you know, and I always thought, like, well, if you just stick by me, and even my mom thought this at some point, and my parents just tried to love me sober. I mean, they didn't know what to do, you know. They didn't have anyone in their, no one in my family is an alcoholic but me. So that's why I was like, I don't know where it came from, you know. You know, so I, this guy, and I thought, you know, if he's my life, I'll be fine. We'll get through this. You know, we had planned, we were going to get married, we were going to build this family. He was in the military, you know, everything was going to be fine, you know. But every single time, it's like when Kelly starts drinking, you know, all bets are off, you know. And there were so many, like, they talk about in the second step, it's like that insanity, you know, like, time after time, I do the same thing, expecting different results, like, and time after time, there's no defense between me and that first drink, you know, and I didn't know that I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I didn't know about this spiritual disease. I didn't know anything. Like, I'd walked into an AA meeting when I was 16. I had been to countless doctors, countless rehabs, and they probably mentioned it many a times, but I was always thinking about, what am I going to do when I get out of here? Like out of the appointment or out of the rehab, or, you know, and it was always like, I always thought I could just pick myself back up together, like, when the guy was gone, I would meet somebody in the Safeway, or I'd meet somebody at the bar, and we would, you know, like, go on our lives. And, like, I was just kind of living this, like, imagination and delusion that I'd always basically end up either in my bedroom drinking, or who knows? Who knows where it would be? You know, so that relationship ended up, it ended right around before I got sober. But, you know, time after time, You know, I loved him, and I wanted to do anything for him, you know. And we had this one talk one day, and it was the day before New Year's. And he was like, please, just let's go out and have a good night. And I was like, that's fine. I'll drink at the pre-party, right? And so we're at the pre-party, and it's like that you start drinking, and you're like, things are like, well, I can drink a little bit more later. It's fine. And so I do, and we ended up going to this bar in D.C., and, you know, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, people aren't acting right. I need to make sure you know that you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. And I ended up, like, you know, hitting him a couple times. I broke a ring open on his face. I beat up some of his friends. And that whole next day, and I was probably in my 20s, early 20s, so I got sober at 23, and I spent the whole next day making these apology phone calls, you know, like, I'm so sorry, I won't do that again, I won't do that again. And the next night, we were going to this New Year's Eve party, and it's a small group, and it was that same deal. Like, we went to a dinner party before, and there's like seven people or something, eight people, and it's, I felt irritable, discontent, uncomfortable, I mean, you name it. And it was like, and I knew these people. This guy I had been with for 4+ years, I knew him. I knew all these people. But when you get me in those social settings, I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know what to say. I want you to like me, but I think you hate me, so I'm going to be a bitch. I know you're not supposed to use bad language. Sorry. I'm going to be a brat to you, or I'm going to be mean. Like that defense mechanism. It's like the missing the life the manual on how to be a human being, you know, or the manual on living life, basically. And you know, so I thought, well, let me just have a glass of wine. Let me just calm the nerves down a little bit. Things will be fine. So I have a glass of wine, which turns into a bottle of wine. And then we go to a party later, and that turns into a bottle of vodka. And then the next thing I know, you know, and I'm still conscious. I know what I'm doing. Next thing you know, they're not acting right again. So I'm out in his car, kicking his windshield in. And first I was going to kill myself because I wanted to show him, you know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, I just constantly thought about myself. And then I, you know, I was like, I'm not going to kill myself. So I decided to kick his windshield in instead, to punish him. And you know, I remember coming in that later that night and I started feeling remorseful, like, you know, and the only thing I knew was to just drink more. And you know, I told him that a deer jumped on his car because that made more sense, that a random deer would just come out Potomac and start jumping on someone's car. You know, and everyone's like, just like, you're crazy. They knew, they're like, you need to stop drinking, you know, and even, I don't know, you know, he still stayed with me for a while, you know, and I'd gone down to school and I left, you know, I spent some time in Roanoke College, and I love it. One of my friends here is from Roanoke College, and it's funny because we drank together, and we actually had the same amount of time sober, pretty much, which is just so bizarre how things happen in this world. Because she lives in Charlottesville, and I live in D.C., and I ran into her 3 years ago at an AA event, and it's just amazing. It's like, what it reminds me is that, like, I need to be present and show up for my life today, and amazing things happen, you know. But anyways, I just kind of on a tangent because I thought about Roanoke College, where I was pretty much failing out, you know. And I thought, like, well, I'll change here, I'll go here, I'll do this, you know. And I ended up back at my parents' house, and it was the same thing, but different place, you know. Now it was just trying to find the liquor cabinet key, you know. And I eventually found it. It was hidden between two plates in one of the, a cabinet hanging on a wall. It took me about a couple weeks to find it, but I found it. Which, when you're that determined, you know, you know, and eventually they boxed up their liquor and moved it downstairs in the workbench, but I found it. And instead of, like, I always poured water back into it, so I was, like, drinking water down liquor, but, you know, they only brought it out for, like, family events. And I remember my brother wasn't living at home at this time, and I was almost 21, and I remember they brought it up for a family reunion, and I'd already started drinking that morning, and, you know, people were already coming up to me asking me if I was okay and how much I had drank already, so they brought up this box, and at the end of the night, my dad was standing by the kitchen sink, and he was like, you know, the rum or the whiskey bottle wasn't dark, it was clear, you know, and he asked me if I drank it, and I was like, I didn't drink that. I'm like, who else would, like, go down to a box that was taped up and untape it to drink it, you know? And still to this day, like, whenever I go to my parents' house and I grab a bottle of water, I look at it twice, because I put vodka in bottled waters and I'd have it in my car wherever I was going. I needed to survive, I needed to drink, you know? That's pretty much what it boils down to. This world felt too hard. Living on life's terms felt too hard, when really life's terms weren't all that hard. You know, at times they were, you know, bad things happened, good things happened, but it was always a turn to the drink. And you know, eventually, so living at home was a problem, got to go somewhere else, went up to Baltimore, ended up having more hospital visits, ending up more, you know, worried phone calls, another rehab. You know, drugs were a big part of my story. I did a lot of drugs. That's what I'm going to tell you about my drug history. I did a lot of them, you know, but when it came down to it, it could be a bottle of vodka, it could be a bottle of rum, it could be whiskey, it could be Milwaukee's Best Beast or whatever that stuff's called. That's so nasty. It could be warm, it could be whatever it is, you know. And I remember going in Virginia or Roanoke, I remember discovering Aristocrat vodka, where it came in the plastic bottle and you could drop it and it wouldn't break, and it was great. It was so gross. We were actually talking about that on the way up, because I still can't drink Diet Dr. Pepper because the tastes remind me of each other, because it was like the only thing I had around me in the mornings. And, you know, so, but anyway, so it's just, I loved alcohol. And, you know, so I went up to Baltimore, you know, that didn't seem to work. Eventually, my parents took away my car. I got pulled over one night by I don't know if it was citizen's arrest, but I guess it was a married couple managed to pull me over. It was on Route 29 going up to Baltimore. You know, that whole day, it was like, it just like you look back and you think about what was going on that day. And what happened was, I was living in Baltimore. I lost my license. I was 21, but I lost my license. We went to Ocean City for the weekend, a family event. I came back to Baltimore. I needed my passport, so I drove to Potomac. My parents had gone out for the day. Before going back up to my apartment in Baltimore, the liquor cabinet was open. I mean, there's just no defense, you know. There's no thought. There's no nothing. Pour myself a glass of whiskey, you know. And so I did that, and I don't really remember much until I remember this nice couple standing by my car, holding my car keys. And my parents were, I guess, on their way, and I came to the next morning, and I was like, I should be in Baltimore. This is weird. I went to go grab my car keys, and my mother was like, what are you doing? And I was like, all right, let's put the puzzle back together and see what happened. You know, so I ended up graduating college, which is really shocks me sometimes, because I was told I was going to amount to nothing. I had the bare minimum. My parents, so I pulled the card a lot. If you don't do this, I'm going to kill myself. I abused everyone around me, you know, and my parents really believed me. And so they tried to help me as much as possible. My mother did a lot of my homework, a lot of my papers. It's sad, you know, thinking about it today, but they really did. I mean, I put them through the ringer, you know. I put them through the ringer. And there was never, I don't know if there was ever I'm sorry's or anything, you know, but it didn't even matter. Those words meant nothing. Nothing. And so I ended up coming home, and it was, so I was 22, and my parents were like, you can live here until you get a job, and then we want you out, you know? And I was like, okay, I can do that. So I got a job, and in my life for the next 6 months before I got my DWI. Now, I had been arrested. I had been pulled over. I never managed to get a DWI until this point. And I've hit people in the McDonald's drive-thru so many times in the early 5 a.m. shifts when you're going to get food, and it's really starting to get sunny, maybe 6 a.m. You just hit the people in front of you. Done that so many times, but never seemed to get in trouble or anything like that. I was pretty much, I had one friend left that we would drink and do drugs in his parents' house in his loft area and talk about all the stuff we were going to do with our lives. And we'd end up there every weekend. And I would go to bed at 6, 7 p.m., wake up at 7 a.m. and go to work. My mom would always cook dinner. She would always have a place for me, but I never felt like I could sit there. And that was me. You know, I felt disgusted. But I always thought, again, like, something's going to happen, you know, and that guy that I was with for so long was, you know, he was in and out of my life, but we were done for the most part, and you know, and even when that relationship ended, I remember this feeling, I can buy liquor, what doesn't matter, you know, and I remember having that conscious feeling, like, just didn't matter, and, you know, so in December of 2003, I'm driving home from work, and I think I'm going to buy a bottle of vodka, right? And then I thought, well, you're probably going to drink it all. And I thought, well, it doesn't really matter. Just buy it. You know, we'll figure it out later. And I'm, like, having this conversation. It's just, it's like, going back and forth. And it's a Tuesday evening, early evening. Needless to say, I bought the bottle of vodka. And my parents had gone out that night, and I was a big drunk dialer. So if you had been friends with me or knew me, you got a phone call randomly at times. And so I did call this one guy I hadn't seen since high school, and I guess I was gonna go to his house. And I'm in the blackout. This is kind of what was told to me later. My brother tried to stop me because he saw the condition I was in. And so he followed me out, and I hit a parked car in my parents' neighborhood. The end of their street's going down. I hit the parked car, it went that way on top of their hill on the house, of their own house. Thank God there was no children out. Thank God it was December and it was cold, because it was like 7 o'clock or something like that. Thank God nobody else was hurt. I was barely hurt, which shocks me sometimes. I had like a bloody nose. Remember my police report was pretty much like I said, I'm effing drunk, just arrest me. And I got 4 citations. They gave me a DWI, a DUI. I didn't know they could do that, but they can. a speeding ticket. They throw things on, failure to control your vehicle. Obviously, if you get like a DWI, failure to control your vehicle. It's like a hand in hand almost. And they took me to a. They took me to a jail, but they took me to a holding cell. And I do remember being handcuffed to the table. I do remember them telling me, your blood alcohol is at 0.3. And my blood alcohol has been that high before. I experienced that in hospitals, coming to the next morning and having them telling me that and thinking that maybe if I stick to beer and wine, this wouldn't have happened. Maybe if I had my Coke or Ritalin, this wouldn't have happened. I mean, that's where it went to right away. Like, maybe if I had speed, this wouldn't have been an issue, And they released me to my brother, and they took me home, and my mom found me later that night drinking the rest of my vodka in the shower. And my car was gone, obviously, because it wasn't total, but it was almost totaled. I mean, it was gone for like a couple of months being worked on. But anyway, my mom told me later on that she was more confused, like she was more disturbed the fact that I was in the shower drinking, not that I got a DWI. Like, she could understand that, but she couldn't understand that why would you be drinking in the shower after that. But if you've just been handcuffed to a table, I mean, why not? But, why wouldn't you, But that's the whole thing. It was like, you put alcohol on me, and then I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if I'm going to stop. I don't know if I'm going to keep going. I don't know what I'm going to do, and that was not my plan that morning. Like, I went to work that morning. That wasn't my plan. And my dad stayed home the next day, and he was teary-eyed, and he was disturbed, obviously. And I remember asking him 2 questions. And I honestly felt like these were good questions. I said, do you think I'm going to go to jail? And he just looked at me. And I said, when do you think I'm going to get my car back? I really need my car back. And he was like, and it was just... And now I understand, why he didn't answer me, because they were ridiculous, I barely made eye contact with anybody anymore. This was, I couldn't look people in the eye anymore. Like, I felt so disgusted, and most of the time was like, did I call you? Did I talk to you when I was drinking? Did I say something to you? Did I hurt you? I never knew. And, so I went to a rehab, strongly because I didn't want to go to jail. My lawyer said I was looking at jail time because of the surroundings of my accident and or incident, whatever you want to call it. I didn't want to do that, so I was like, I'll do whatever, So I went to this rehab, and it was the first time that my eyes were open for a minute, and I saw the traditions and the steps on the wall. Now, they looked good on the wall. They looked like, okay, I can do that. I knew I was an alcoholic. I was telling people I was an alcoholic since I was 18, 19 years old. I knew I could say that. But what I thought that meant was, I can drink, leave me alone. Like, I thought that was, that's what alcoholics do. They drink. So don't talk to me about this. You know, don't confront me about my drinking. And but the thing was, is I never was willing to do anything about it. So I could say it, and I was always a talker. I could say whatever I wanted. I would say whatever I was wanting to get you off my back, but I would never take any kind of action to change it. You know, and so I saw the steps, and I was like, oh, I've done that one. Not going to do that one. Definitely not doing that. You know, it was like going down the list in my mind, and for the rehab, to stay in the rehab, you had to get a sponsor, you had to go get a home group, and I was like, okay, I can do this, you know. So I walked into this meeting one night. They would circle meetings for me there, and you know, and there were some of the counselors there that had been sober, and because before when I went to rehabs, I had a backpack full of beer and or liquor, and I was going out and getting drunk afterwards, and so I thought this was a little progress, like I was actually a little trying to pay attention a little bit more. But, you know, so I went there, and so I went to this meeting, and, you know, this woman just, she didn't know who I was, but I knew her name, so she became the name of my sponsor. And the meeting that I walked into became the name of my home group, you know. So from the beginning, it was like, I'm going to do this my way, you know. And I didn't know, like, you know, that was a big issue in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't know that that was like, no, God's way, you know, someone else's way. But so I did this, you know, I got my car back, and I thought things were great, you know. I thought, well, not great, but I thought things were manageable, right? So another couple of months later, it was June of 2004. Now, so I did a couple of months before I came in Alcoholics Anonymous until today. You know, it was a Sunday morning, and the night before, we were at my grandparents' anniversary party. Just turned 23, and my mom looked at me, and she said, I think things are getting better. And I was like, yeah, I think they are. And that was like the kiss of death. You know, the next morning, there's a bottle of vodka in my sock drawer. Like I said, this wasn't my plan, but I started drinking, and I ended up pushing her to the ground and getting into my car and driving up to Baltimore. And that night, now, I had done many things to get alcohol and drugs before, many things. It didn't matter. Sold myself, you know. And so I went to Baltimore. I went to this guy's house I hadn't seen in years. He took me to this party. We went to this party. They had drugs there. They had alcohol. I had already been drinking all day. And, it was summertime. You know, that talks about the demoralization, you know, humiliation, demoralization. And, I basically sold myself for drugs and alcohol that night. Found out that I had slept with three married men for crystal meth. And I only say that because that's where, you know, that's where I was going to, you know. And what happened was, is that, you know, I came home about, like, you know, the next morning. It was a Monday morning. I had to be at work. You know, my parents had to pay, you know, it was just... It was kind of like I had that feeling that morning, and I was like, I'm done. I can't do this. But I changed my mind. Hours later, I was drinking again, you know. And I remember when I got home, my dad tried to take away my car keys, and he was like, you've been drinking and driving again, blah, blah. And, you know, in the moment, I thought, if they knew I was doing enough crystal meth to keep me sober, they wouldn't be so on my back. So I told them, you know, I told them that I did enough speed, that I was a fine driver, and I was good, you know, and there was just like this, they were just like, their eyes were dead, you know, and it was like looking at one of us when we come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, like there's just that emptiness and that deadness. And I felt like a broken human being after like that next day. And it was not necessarily like the acts. It was more of it's like I couldn't imagine a life like this, and I couldn't imagine a life not drinking, you know. Because like I said, I changed my mind, which I understand now is that that for me, it's that powerlessness. I am 100% powerless. Without a program of action outlined in the big book, a spiritual way of life, I am absolutely powerless. I'm powerless over everything. You know, and I didn't know that. And, you know, couple more drunks in me until I got sober, you know. I had a what looked like a party at my parents' house one weekend when they went out of town, and it was just me. Like, I completely trashed their place, mowed the lawn in a blackout. I came to when in the morning I had no clothes on. My bottle of vodka was in a million pieces in the tub. My cell phone was broken in half. I threw up all over my room. I couldn't tell you one thing about that night, but I was all alone, and you know, they knew something had happened because I managed to, like, they kind of cornered my car into the garage. So they put my car right here. They put my mom's Jeep behind me. So the only way for me to get out is to literally move it like this by turning the wheel so much, which I managed to do that night. And they hid my car keys in my dad's filing cabinet, which I managed to find. And it cost me about $1,000 to fix my car because I blew the power steering from turning it so much and hit the back and forth of the garage. I mean, so it was just a mess, you know. And when they came home from that weekend, I put the car keys on the hook, you know. And they like knew and they had hid them, you know. It was just so stupid. So that was July 2004, and I've ended up coming to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 2004, and I remember it was this Saturday night meeting. It was 8:00. It was in a church in Bethesda, and there was a lot of people there. There was a fire code hazard, so they were asking people to step out for a minute so new people could step in. And of course, you know, I got there at 8:05. And I remember sitting like tucked in the back a little bit. I don't remember anything that was said, but I do. What did happen was, is this girl came up to me and she said she would help me. And I hadn't heard those words from someone my age. I was 23. The last time people were saying anything to me, they were calling me a skank. They were calling me disgusting. They were telling me to get out of the room. They were trying to physically remove me from places, which I don't blame them. You know, my behavior was just, you know, it was absurd, you know. And so this girl, she was like, I'll help you. And I was like, I was kind of shocked, you know. But for some reason, I listened to her. And, you know, she became my first sponsor. And she only stuck around for about a year. She ended up relapsing on heroin, and then I got a new sponsor. But what she did is she told me to get a service position. Well, she didn't tell me to get one. She told me I was going to pick up cigarette butts, which sometimes it's better. Don't leave me a decision. Just tell me what to do, you know. So my first service position was picking up cigarette butts at this meeting in D.C. But now looking back, it's like what it does for me. It's like when I'm of service, one, I'm not thinking about myself, and I'm being useful to other people, you know. And it's keeping me busy, you know. But anyway, but I didn't know that at the time. I was just pissed off. I was like, I can't believe I'm picking up cigarette butts. Yet I smoked, you know. She started taking me through the big book. I mean, she's got me involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But what I found out to become is that, you know, that first step in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that I'm powerless over alcohol, my life has become unmanageable, that, you know, my dad wanted to put a breathalyzer in my car because he thought I was going to die or kill somebody else. I had to log my mileage every day. I was only allowed to go a certain mileage per day, and I had to hand my car keys to them every night and pick them up every morning. So there's something in that that's not manageable, you know? And the fact that, too, on my insides, I felt like a broken human being. I felt empty. I felt dead. And I couldn't imagine anything, you know? I couldn't imagine any kind of life left. And, you know, and what I found was that, because I thought, you know, I'll stay here for 3 months, I'll stop drinking, and I'll be good. We'll be good, you know. But what I found is that you remove the alcohol from me, and I'm irritable. You're the problem. You're looking at me the wrong way. You're not treating me the way I think I should be treated, whatever. And that standard keeps growing, you know. It's that, like, I'm insatiable. You give me $1,000, I want $10,000, you know. It keeps changing over and over again, you know. And I didn't know that, I didn't know all this stuff about me. Like, I knew that when I drank, bad things happen. I knew that. But I didn't know about all these character defects. I started learning those more and more the longer I stayed sober. Doing my fourth and fifth step, like writing all that stuff down about myself, all that garbage, all that hate, all that stuff I blamed on other people, myself, you know. And I had to learn how to forgive myself, and forgive other people. And that took some time, you know. And I don't know if I really realized it at first, you know. Because at first what happened was, like, I got involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started to feel better. I got a boyfriend and I was like, this is good. People are talking to me. I feel great, you know. But what happened was is that life happens. You know, life continues to happen when you're sober. And and bad things happen, and you know, and I remember starting to feel that same kind of feeling again, and I started to self-medicate myself with shopping. I started to self-medicate myself with other things in sobriety, 4 or 5 years into sobriety, you know, and it came to a point where I was $80,000 in credit card debt, I was 4 years sober, and I was miserable, and I was thinking about drinking left and right. Yet, I had service positions, I had a home group, I was picking up women all the time, AA, see me, like, be a superwoman, you know, but I was yelling at my mother anytime she would call me. She tried to give me relationship advice, and I would freak out on her, yet she's been married for now 41 years to the same man, so she does know what she's talking about, you know, or she has her experience, you know, but I was pretty much treating people the same way, and because I didn't feel good, so it's your fault, you know, and that's just kind of the what happens. Like, I don't feel good, I'm going to take it out on you, you know. I'm in financial fear, I'm going to take it out on you, you know. And it took, so about 4 or 5 years sober, she asked me if I was drinking. And I was very insulted. And, you know, and looking back at that, now, I did the best I could at the time, you know. And I would say for a while, I said I believed in God. I said I believed in a higher power, but I believed in shopping. I believed that because that when I bought something, it made me feel better. But I didn't want to stop doing it, so I didn't want to like get honest about it until it was like enough pain. But around that time, it was very clear that after you know revisiting this, and this is like the very important part, revisiting all of this with a sponsor. You know, I was working with a sponsor, but she didn't know half the truths. You know, and I wasn't doing the suggestions. I was doing it half, you know, and I was half measures avail you nothing. I was getting nothing, you know, and it was very clear that when I was a month sober, that I thought it would be great to sit down my parents together because they're a unit. They're not separate people. They're a unit, and tell them I was sorry. And that's what I thought my amends were to them, and that was not correct at all. And what happened was is because they were really happy that I was sober, and they were really, and I thought I deserved some gold star for being sober. Like, look at me, I'm sober, now we're great, you know. But there was so much wreckage and so much damage, you know, that I wasn't even addressing and that I was still living that same way in a sobriety, yet I have new women in my car, yet I have service positions, yet I go to 7 to 10 meetings a week. You know, there's something, you know, there's something wrong there, and the common denominator was me, you know. And the key part was like, you know, relying on a higher power. And I believe, you know, and it's only been really in the past couple of years that I've really seen that if I'm going to continue on, one, being happy and sober, I need that conscious contact with a higher power. I have to, you know. And it talks about it over and over and over in the book, you know. He can't fix me. Those clothes can't fix me. Money can't fix me. The house can't fix me. My parents' love couldn't fix me. That man I was going to marry, he wanted to fix me, but he couldn't, you know. I suffer from a spiritual malady that only a higher power can fix. And, you know, and for a long time, it's like, I didn't know what that looked like, you know, and I had a hard time. It's like, well, this isn't working, you know, I still feel miserable or blah, 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 you know. But over time and through making these amends, about 5 years sober, I reached out to, let me back up. So I wanted to make amends to that ex-boyfriend, right away, because he had to know how good I was doing. And he had, and I wanted him back in my life, and he had to know, you know. And my sponsor said, let's hold off on that one, you know. And thank God, you know, I listened to that one. And I did, when we revisited it after that whole, let's be of service to everyone. Let's practice the St. Francis prayer to everyone. Let's practice these principles in all your affairs, not just when you pick and choose, you know. And when I started living like a sober human being, you know, things started to change in these relationships, you know, and I started to have a different, my motives were different, you know, and when I revisited making amends to this guy that I dated for so long, it was about five or six years ago, I don't know, and, you know, I reached out to him, and unfortunately he had been redeployed to Afghanistan. And I was like, okay, you know, so I went back to my sponsor, and we revisited how to do this. And, you know, the timing was, you know, like, well, let's write him a letter. And then when he comes face to face, you can see him, you know. And I was like, okay, well, the letter couldn't happen because he was moving so much. So let's do an email. Okay. So like, okay. And so I did, you know, and I said what I needed to say. And he did write back, and you know, but the first time it didn't matter what he said back. Like, I did what I needed to do, you know. And you know what happened was, and it's a horrible, horrible event, you know. And I don't wish this upon anybody, you know. But he was killed in Afghanistan 6 months later, and you know, and he had a family, he had a wife, he had a kid that he didn't even know about yet, and I say that just because I saw something that, you know, of course I was so sad when it happened and it was very horrible, but I felt at peace. I felt at peace with this man, and I felt like, that the God that I thought was like this way or that way, it was more of like, there's human beings out there just that are wrong or whatnot. It's not like God's a bad person, you know. And also what happened from that experience is that his wife was so worried about how I was going to find out. I barely knew the woman, you know, and she came up to me at the viewing and everything, was so more worried about me because of that. He had given light to her about a different person, you know. Even though it was like 6 months. It was still somebody that was different, because I was reaching out to him and I was seeing how he was doing. I was asking about his family. I wasn't telling him about myself. I mean, I did tell him I was sober, and this is what we do about the ninth step amends. But I was asking him about his life. I was taking an interest in another human being's life, you know. And that's what I started to learn how to do, you know. Like when I would be with my mother, I would ask her about her. When I was at her house, I learned how to be service to her, you know, not go sleep on her couch and eat her food and then complain about how tired I am because so I can get her sympathy, you know. But it was more about being of service to other people and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I learned that from you guys, you know. I didn't just one day was like, oh, I'm going to be nice to everybody, you know. People started showing me here in Alcoholics Anonymous how to act, how to live sober, you know, so like so many things have happened in my sobriety, you know. I got married a couple years ago, and I do believe, you know, that's a true partnership that I never really could have managed to be in, because I was always so concerned with what I'm going to get out of this relationship, you know. And recently, you know, I've been starting to work with a new sponsor over the past couple, maybe like 8-9 months or so, or since the end of the summer. And she is very big on me finding, connecting a relationship with a higher power. And she's directing me back to the big book. And we're actually going through the steps again, you know. And what I've learned is that no matter how long I've been sober, that these steps, the basics, the beginning, everything, like the back to the basics, can still work today, you know. And it's amazing how, you know, I started to get a little bit miserable in sobriety, you know, because I started to get that, I want that next fix, you know. I thought getting engaged would work. It didn't. I got married. It's nice, but it didn't work. I got the house, and then it became another obsession, you know. And it's funny because it's like, the past year and a half or so, I'm going through the same problems I was then, but I feel so much different about it today than I did then. And it's the same problem, but I can only relate it back to is that I have a stronger connection with my higher power today. I use prayer. I usually read something, a page in the Daily Reflections every morning. I send my sponsor 5 things that I'm grateful for every morning, and this is all suggestions by her. But it's like when I use some other person's suggestions on my life, things work out so much better. And they could be the same answer sometimes, but it's just my perception on life is a little skewed till today. Like, so I see, like, I still have alcoholism. I'm not cured. All I have is a daily reprieve based on, based on what I do, you know? And so I know it's like I've redoubled my efforts, you know? I found meetings that, not just checking off the box, but it's like meetings that where I can be of service to, meetings where I can bring something back to, and working with other women, you know, and it's amazing. It's like these things in my life, like I really pictured my life to be the hotel room with the 8-ball of cocaine, the liquor, and by myself, like. She or he could be there, but it didn't really matter, you know. And now it's like I get excited about driving an hour and a half, 2 hours with a sponsee to Madison, Virginia, you know. It's like, and it's so amazing, like the difference of things that I get excited about in life for, you know. And like, and I can honestly say it's like I have bad days, I have good days, you know. I've had to make amends again in sobriety, you know, like I made amends to my parents as separate human beings, like 5 years ago, you know, and we've had little arguments back and forth, and I realize it's like I'm a human being. I'm going to have arguments. I'm going to argue with my husband. I'm going to have little tiffs with my friends. But it's not the end of the world. Two, I don't have to completely shut them off, like, because mine would be either like, well, you're done, you know. I don't have to. Those are my answers today, you know, that it's like I can be a human being, but I can be wrong. It's better when I'm wrong, but I can make mistakes today, you know. As long as I don't defend them, I feel like I got a good shot, you know. I forgot what I was gonna say. I'm excited because we're still going through the big book again, and we're going through the rest of the steps. So it's gonna be like so different in my fourth and my next 8 step, But really seeing it's like the best I feel today is when I am talking to another alcoholic, when I'm not talking about myself, which it's kind of weird to even like say, but it's like I go to bed today with a different feeling of peace that I've wanted my whole life. I've just wanted that peace my whole life. And I do believe today that it's no longer my way versus my higher power's way. It's more of infinite possibilities. When I rely on a higher power, I have no idea what's going to happen, you know. And when what I'm supposed to do, show up where I'm supposed to be and be present. Because I always showed up places, but was I present? No, not at all. You know, I was like far out in space. Mm-hmm. But what it's like when I do those on a daily basis, I have no idea what's going to happen. Like, my good friend Kipton, we went to Roanoke College together. We drank together. We did some crazy stuff together. And then 3 years ago, we were at this AA event in DC, and I mentioned she lives in Charlottesville, and I didn't even want to go. I was like, I don't really feel like going around all these AA people. Blah blah. My husband wasn't really feeling that well. You know, we had just got married. I thought, let me just skip it. You know, but I had always went, and so we went. And literally, it's like I turned my head, and there she is standing there. And I was like, oh my God, you know. And so it's like I can look back at those things, and like I can see that it's not this like I can see like that. I can see like a higher power working in my life. I can see a higher power working in my life when I made amends to that guy I dated for so long. I can see a higher power working in my life when I know I can say, I can cry, like, you know, I'm going through a struggle right now, you know, I'm having a hard time with something, and it's been a couple of years, and, you know, it's, but like, and I can cry, and I can be upset, and I can have bad days, and I can be upset about it, but like, and I know the difference is, like, the next day in the morning, I know I can, after talking to my sponsor, I can honestly feel like it'll be okay and trust that, you know, and trust that I have no idea what the plan's going to be, but it's like when I change that like, 6 and 7 talk, like, the change of attitude, I usually have a better day, and I'm usually nicer to people, you know, because I've definitely lived in the opposite where I'm thinking about I'm not getting mine. It's really unfair because you're getting what I want. God must hate me. And then what usually happens is when I live in that all day or half the day, I go home. I'm a little irritable. I don't want to pick up my phone. I usually say something snappy to my husband, and I usually go to bed a little cranky, and I usually wake up a little cranky, you know, and I mean, it varies from what I say and what I do, but You know, like, I know the difference today, you know, and it's like these practical actions that, you know, I can use prayer and opposite positive action and kind of be open-minded. And my sponsor keeps, she keeps harping, she's like, just be open-minded. And it's amazing when I am open-minded, so many things happen, you know, whether I like it or not. But I am out of time. I want to thank you again for inviting me up here. It's absolutely an honor and privilege. Alcoholics Anonymous, hands down, you know, is it's changed my life. I love my life today, and I know it's changed the people closest to me. You know, they are externally grateful for you guys as well. So thank you. Mm-hmm.